Live from the heart of the universe, this is the online edition of the Life Changes Show.
Look at the bright lights. Look at the bright.
With tonight's guest, attorney, law professor, and author, Robin Boyle Lejeur.
Look at the night sky. Look at the night sky.
And performance guest, Colin Martin. I am Mark Lejeur, and now our host, the MC, the master of change, Filippo Voltaggio.
I was in a big box store just last night, and I happened to be in a long line waiting to return something. And early on, I noticed an older woman sitting by herself. And I noticed her, I think, also because she looked uncomfortable. She looked lost, even though she was seated. That's how I'm like, that woman is lost, is what I thought. And she did look confused. And I kept an eye on her as I walked through the line, and I'd see her get up and look around and look down the line and look up the line and sit down again. And as I approached her, as the line was getting towards her, I looked at her and she looked at me and I smiled, and she took that as an opening to tell me her story. And I didn't understand everything she was saying because she spoke another language, but and her English was very broken, but I could tell that it was helping her to tell somebody that she had lost her daughter, or her daughter had left her, she didn't know what to do. And so she looked again down the line and up the line. And I thought to myself, I wish this store had a loudspeaker so that I could go up somewhere and say, Mrs. So-and-so is looking for her daughter or something, and help unite them. But I was thinking, I wish I knew, what do we do in a situation like this? Because this is, poor thing was very uncomfortable. Anyway, thankfully, before long, her daughter did come, and they were united, and the woman was so relieved, and she looked at me and thanked me for my caring. And so, interestingly enough, in an unrelated situation, I then eventually went into the store to buy something. I didn't have a cart with me. I was just getting one or two items. And as I was going down the aisles looking for what I was going to get, I walked up to a particular aisle, and a woman saw me, and she looked like she was very intense, and like she had a concerned look on her face, and her voice was emphatic. Unfortunately, I didn't understand her accent either, but she said something, and I stopped and I said, I'm sorry. And she stood there like she was the adult in the room. I could tell she wasn't working there. And she stood there and she says, "Is this your son?" And I looked to where she was pointing, and there was an abandoned cart full of things and a little boy inside the cart, not in the seating part, but inside the cart, playing with his phone or on his phone, but just a very little boy. And I knew exactly what was happening in that moment. And I thought, I wish there was something we could do. What do we do? Like, how do we get the store's attention? Like, I wish they had a loudspeaker. But I was so grateful that this woman was standing guard. And probably when she did find the parents or guardians, that she probably gave them a little bit of an education, saying you don't want to leave your child unattended in a big store with so many people around. Like, people just might not know or might not think. And I am so grateful for people like our guests today who are bringing awareness and solutions, of which we need so many for these kinds of situations that we're going to be talking about today.
We love to tackle kind of the more positive, change-oriented topics on this show. Mm-hmm. This is a heavier, dialogue frame for tonight, but so important. And of course, we've over the years talked about sources' involvement, because what are the odds when certain things happen? And you know, this topic that we're going to learn more about is just becoming more and more topical every day in recent weeks. And I, as bad as it is, I think it's good because we're talking about it, and people are paying attention and asking questions, and that can lead to it getting fixed.
And I hate to say, Mark, you and I both have a friend who was talking about this stuff 20 something years ago. And when she first approached the subject with me, I wasn't sure what she meant. I said, what is trafficking mean? I don't even understand trafficking.
Just a few years ago, I was discussing it with some friends and bringing up certain statistics and that, and they looked at me like I, it was crazy. So it has not been on the radar, and when it's not on the radar, then you can't call it out, and there's no motivation to heal it.
You know, Mark, I spoke with our guest today, as you know, and I thanked Robin for coming at this from, she's a mother, she's a member of her community, she's an attorney, and she's a professor, and brings all of that to the table and in this book.
That's part of why, not only because I know her well and have great admiration for her, I have tremendous respect for her and the careful thought and the heartful consideration that she puts into everything, of course, translates to this work.
And we've titled this episode pretty much directly from her book, How to Protect Children from Cults and Traffickers. This is our episode 879. And our featured interview guest is an attorney, a law professor, member of the board of directors for the International Cultic Studies Association, and author, Robin Boyle Leger, JD. Welcome, Robin, to the Life Changes Show.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And I appreciate hearing the words of my brother-in-law, Mark Leger, and Filippo. It's wonderful to speak with you again.
It's wonderful to speak with you again as well. And especially, I felt so comfortable being able to speak on this subject with you. It is touchy, and yet it shouldn't be, or you tell us.
Well, it's a somber topic. It's a serious topic. And if you're in the car listening and your children are there, you might want to turn the volume down at this point. The prevalence of cults and trafficking, the numbers are alarming. And online solicitation is probably the most dangerous occurrence right now that children are facing. And it's something that we all have to pay attention to. But luckily, there are resources out there that can help families and parents and teachers and law enforcement in understanding what is happening and trying to keep our children safe. And the book was written for children, although anyone can be trafficked, anyone can be coerced into joining a cult. It's not only child victims, but they are probably targeted more than the older folks. But when I say anybody, I do mean anybody in terms of class and race, ethnicity. Anyone can be coerced into one of these pernicious organizations.
So let us start with what we're talking about. So when one says human trafficking, for those who don't know still to this day, what in the world is human trafficking?
Sure. Human trafficking is the exploitation of another human being for sex or for labor. There's two kinds of trafficking, sex trafficking and labor trafficking. We hear more often about sex trafficking. It is very prevalent, but labor trafficking is also an issue in the United States and around the world. There are globally approximately 27 million people being trafficked around the world. And there's also
27
million people. It is second to the drug trade in terms of profitability. And trafficking actually has been around for as long as we know existence. So it goes all the way back to the Roman Empire. Historians have found evidence of human trafficking. But in the United States, the human trafficking laws were enacted in 2000. So that is why it has taken a while for us to become aware of it. The prosecutions of cases have had mixed results. More recently, I would say a significant case was the case against the sex cult Nexium. The defendant there was Keith Raniere. That took place in the Southern District of New York. And there have been other prosecutions in the trial courts and the appellate courts in state and in federal courts. So human trafficking is the exploitation of another for sex or for labor. It is slavery is what it is. And we need to be concerned in terms of trying to keep our children safe so that they do not succumb to pressure online when they're on gaming consoles or if they're approached by an individual on the street.
So where before it was an issue, like you say, an individual on the street, now there's access literally to a child or a person's hand in the sense that their phone is in their hand, right?
That's right. Or they're on their computer at night in their bedroom. And what is happening is that the predators pretend to be teenagers, and they're on these gaming consoles and different platforms, and often they lure the child away from the game that they're playing and direct them into a chat room where they can go back and forth and chat with each other. And the grooming process, and that is the word that's used, grooming, by law enforcement, the grooming process could take 6 months. It could also take a matter of a couple of hours that the Wow. child becomes coerced into doing something. And what that something is not a good result. So it could be that the child's providing pornographic pictures, or the child decides that this is a friend he or she could trust, and they leave their house. And so these scenarios where teenagers leave the house, they get in a car, they think they're visiting a friend and they're not. They get on the train, they think they're meeting up with friends in the city or at a park and they're not, and so forth. So that's what's happening. The in terms of cults, the concern there, college campuses. And cults are still recruiting on college campuses. When my son was in college, I saw in the college paper an article saying, beware of groups that come to campus and hand out pamphlets. Say, we did not invite them on campus. Our campus doors are open. They walk on campus, but be careful. And sure enough, there was a dangerous cult that was recruiting on his college campus, and it happens around the US and outside of the US, of course.
So your book, Taken No More, Protect Yes. Your Children Against Traffickers and Cults. So I would think traffickers and cults are separate, but you are making a connection. There's a connection potentially as well.
Yes, thank you for that. No one has said that quite like that, and that was really well said. So there is a connection. And before the trafficking statutes came out, I was researching and writing about cults and speaking to groups such as the International Cultic Studies Association, of which I'm now a board member, about the dangers of cults, how the law can protect but also fall short, what victims can do, what families can do. And then the trafficking statutes came out, and I said, aha, you know, these trafficking statutes can be used to prosecute cult leaders. And sure enough, we saw that with the case that I just mentioned, the NXIVM case, and some others. The commonality there is that, first of all, anybody can be a victim, number one. Number two, people do not purposely join something that they think is a cult. Just like someone doesn't fall in love with someone they think is a trafficker, right? So there's deceit that happens in both realms in terms of the initiation, and there's grooming in both paths. So the cults very often have a grooming phase, as does the trafficker. If the trafficking is taking that route, which it often does. So we have this grooming phase, and we have victims who are unaware of what is happening to them. The trafficking statutes are written so that for adults, what would need to be proven is fraud, force, or coercion. Those three words don't need to be proven at trial for children, but the idea that the victim is being coerced in some manner is important and essential to the crime of trafficking. And that same phenomenon happens when people join cults, that they are often unaware of what is happening to them, and that their money is being taken. They may be psychologically or physically abused, depending upon the cults. There's a spectrum of organizations out there of various levels of serious behavior.
Wow. It feels like, well, I have so many questions, and I want to get so much information out there. And obviously, so do you, is why you've been doing this, talking about this for a very long time. And that's why you've also put a book out there, especially for parents and for children. So you yourself have we don't have to get into it, but you yourself have a story where you may have found yourself in a situation had it not been for someone stopping that from happening, correct?
That's right. I was in high school, and long story short, I ended up standing on the street corner with someone, a boy about my age. I guess I was about 16 years old, maybe 15, 16, and he was panhandling. And he said he was with, and he named an organization, which I later found out was a cult. And he sounded all very mysterious and mystical, and was starting to get excited and intrigued. He had a biblical name. He went by a biblical name. He was reciting scripture, and I just thought this was all so interesting. And he was talking about going back to find his group. And just as all this was happening, a middle-aged couple walked by, and the woman looked directly at me, and she said, You look like a nice girl. Stay away from this guy. And I'm so glad she said that because off he went to find his group, and I went home. That was my initial experience. I later found out that this particular group uses what's called flirty fishing. And what it is sexual flirtation to try to lure children into the group, young people into the group. And anyway, so that was my initial encounter with a cult.
You do people that are attracted to or find themselves in a situation like trafficking or in a cult, do they have something that's going on with them that may lead them in that direction that could be potentially a clue for a parent or somebody to be able to help a child, or at least watch, or we're going to get into what they could say in a little bit, but are there signs that a parent might see that my child is seeking something?
So, yes, but it doesn't have to be that case. But often we find a few things. In terms of joining cults, it often happens. It could be at any age, but I think the college age, it becomes of interest to someone who is of college age because that is the time in which they are seeking independence, they are open-minded to new ideas, they're experimenting and often trying to find, the secret to life, what is life all about? So in that sense, it's that stage of life. In terms of trafficking, often survivors say that their trafficker was offering them something that they were missing from their home life. Often it's love. And that this was, or perhaps they came from meager means, and that the trafficker is dazzling. The trafficker is offering dinner at a restaurant, perhaps a hotel room. Maybe they've never been to a hotel room, so they are seeing some adventure and a way out of perhaps where they were. The profiles for those who have been trafficked, like I said, it could occur to any child, but often the profiles are children who are LGBTQ, who have perhaps been forced out of their home, children who have left home, who have been abused or who have witnessed abuse. Perhaps they may have already started taking drugs. The traffickers often use drugs to get their victims hooked on drugs and then can more easily coerce and manipulate them. So those are some of the traits, but there was an interesting case that I wrote about in my book about college girls up in Vermont who became intrigued by some guys who came to campus, and before too long, they were trafficked back down in New York City area. And the prosecutors who wrote about that case found it really intriguing in terms of how the girls at first thought these guys were just sort of romantic, but then it turned into something much darker.
One of the things when I was reading through all the materials and listening to you on several videos, the fact that cults can recruit on college campuses is mind-blowing, but I understand certain campuses are open and yeah, what are they going to do? But hopefully there are things they can do, and we're going to talk about what to do. But online I gathered that, but didn't go and think through this part when I found out about self-improvement health spaces, gyms, yoga classes and centers, and talk to us about that kind of stuff.
Yes, there's more and more. I have been reading about some health improvement spaces that can become cult-like. And to be careful of, it's just like anything you join, go in with open eyes, go in with critical thinking skills. If something doesn't seem right, it's probably not right. So trust your gut. And there are instances of meditation groups, yoga groups, etc., where in many circumstances, those are nice and healthy. But in some circumstances, they are not, depending upon how they are being run. The group that I mentioned before, the Nexium group, those were self-help workshops to help develop oneself. Mm. Not all cults are religious. Some are political, some are commercial. There's, for any kind of business that you can think of that people might flock to, there could be an untoward relationship there. So I would say anything that you join, just keep your eyes open and make sure that you are aware of what you are joining, because often people who join cults don't know that it's a cult, but aren't aware of what the organization is actually doing.
You mentioned the word relationships, and of course, relationships also, something can look like a relationship, but it really is intended to lead somewhere, right?
Yes. So in terms of grooming and relationships, what is interesting is that survivors who from trafficking don't see the trafficker as a trafficker. They see the trafficker as their husband or their boyfriend, which is very interesting. So when law enforcement goes in and raids or rescues, or if the survivor somehow comes forward for help, the language that one uses when talking to someone who exited a cult or exited a trafficking situation is very important, because they don't necessarily see their situation the same way as someone on the outside of the group sees the situation.
Yeah, I get that. So, especially with children, but with anybody, somebody on the outside sees something, what can one say? What can one say to prevent? Let's talk about prevention.
Okay. Well, I think prevention can start at home. And the book maps out in a chapter ways to talk to your children to raise a savvy child. And the reason I wrote this chapter was because in one of my speaking engagements with a nonprofit group, and it was during the pandemic, I had a lot of parents online at this meeting, parents and their teenagers. And a parent at the end said, "I'm afraid to send my child to college." And I said, "No, you definitely should send your child to college. Don't let the information that I gave you this evening dissuade you from sending your child to college." So my book is not about keeping your child home. My book is about raising a savvy child so that they can go out and navigate the world with confidence and with intelligence and awareness. And I have a chapter where I break down how to speak to a child at different age-appropriate levels. I also break through this myth about the stranger danger, which was a prevalent phrase when I was raising my children, and I remember talking to my children about stranger danger. Survivors say the problem with that is it is the trafficker is not a stranger very often. The trafficker, the manipulator, is someone they know. So now the phrase is tricky adult. To try to teach your child that some adults may be tricky. These are things to watch out for. An adult should not be asking for directions. An adult should not be coming to a child asking for certain things, offering candy. Will you like to pet my puppy? That kind of thing. Would you like to come in the car? So these are the things to talk to your child about at different appropriate age levels. And my book has those conversations mapped out at different levels.
So in the case of somebody that one suspects is in that kind of a situation, like a trafficking situation or whatnot, that could be also dangerous for the person that suspects it at that point, depending on who the traffickers are, right, and who the cult is. But so how does one navigate that in a general sense?
Okay. So the all of the organizations in law enforcement will say, do not rescue if you're an individual, right? Leave rescue to the professionals, the law enforcement. There are hotlines that you can call if you suspect that trafficking is occurring. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, there's National Human Trafficking Hotline, and there are other organizations like Crime Stoppers. And in every state, there are organizations that are both statewide and local that you can call. Most likely, there's a shelter, there's a domestic violence shelter, there's probably a number of different nonprofit and some government organizations and some NGOs that can offer assistance. I would suggest reaching out to a local or one of these hotlines to call to say that there's something that you suspect. But the advice says do not go in and rescue.
Well, you have in the book even advice for law enforcement, case investigators, yes, and lawyers. Is that because they don't have enough training potentially, or this isn't as fully developed an understanding as it needs to be?
Those, I make a few points there. Training does occur. We still need more resources for training and for dragnets, sting operations that occur and is still occurring and are effective in finding the buyers, rescuing children, arresting the perpetrators, the traffickers, and sending them to trial. All of this takes a lot of resources. It takes a lot of manpower. It takes money. It takes time to build a case and so forth. All of that is occurring around the U.S., and it should continue to occur, and we should continue as a country to devote resources to it.
And have this conversation and awareness.
Awareness. Now, my advice, though, I describe the way in which law enforcement has handled, for instance, in cults, sometimes going in and rescuing children has worked out and sometimes it has not. And I describe those situations, and also I describe some of the conversations with survivors of cults who were rescued as children. And I describe that. I also talk about studies and mental health professionals and their assistance with those who have come out of cults and how they have tried to help them. In terms of law enforcement, there could be some more training. For instance, in speaking to a survivor of a cult or a survivor of trafficking, that conversation may not be a linear conversation. Their understanding of events may not be accurate in terms of when certain things happen. So they may seem like an unreliable witness. And that is why I think training needs to occur so that those who are rescued or those who are willing to come forward can get the help that they need. And also, if there are trials, that they can serve as reliable witnesses on the stand.
A big chunk of your book, Robin, is not only the resources, but the references. And there are so many. In other words, you're not the one saying this. You're the one compiling this, and you're the one bringing it forward. And people can go and check all the references, or as many as they can, that corroborates how prevalent and important this conversation is. Oh, yes. How prevalent the problem is and how important the conversation is.
Yes. And the interesting thing is there's just a limited amount of pages. Even after I wrote the book, I continually come upon more organizations where I am and also nationally that are there to provide assistance for trafficking. And I would say, and also the landscape changes because some are cropping up and others had to shut down because of loss of funding. I would say be aware of what is around you. We have on Long Island courts that are devoted to human trafficking. So there are courts out there and there are services that are both government funded and nonprofits that are there to help people who are in a trafficking situation to get the resources and the help that they need and to get kids off the streets and the help that they need.
Wow. Thank you so much. Robin Boyle Lejeune, Robin, R-O-B-I-N. Boyle, B-O-Y-L-E, and Lejeune, L-A-I-S-U-R-E. RobinBoyleLejeune.com is her website. She's also on Facebook and LinkedIn and on Instagram. The book is available through the publisher, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, the publisher being Bloomsbury. We have links for all of that. Where is the best place, Robin, that you would say for people to start?
For people to start, in terms of,
they could start by getting the book. That would be
would say International Cultic Studies Association has a fabulous library online, and it produces peer-reviewed journal articles and a magazine. I would say if you are at all curious about cults, look up International Cultic Studies Association. The organization also has annual conferences. Our next conference is going to be in San Diego in over 4th of July weekend. I recommend, and they're open. So I would suggest that people look into the acronym is ICSA, I-C-S-A, International Cultic Studies Association. In terms of human trafficking, there are a number of organizations. UNICEF has a lot of good information on its website. So does the Polaris Project, the Deliver Fund on Long Island, the Retreat in Suffolk County, Sanctuary for Families. And as I mentioned, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and the National Human Trafficking Hotline. I suggest looking at all of those sites.
Robin, maybe we can get that list from you and we can post it on the show, potentially with this this interview, once it is available, and people can get all of that all at the same time as well.
Sure, I'm happy to.
Robin, thank you so much for being on the show and sharing this information, again, from the place that you're sharing, both from as an attorney and as a professor of law, as a mother, as a concerned citizen. Thank you so much. It's
thank you.
Very appreciated. Taken No More, Protect Your Children Against Traffickers and Cults. Robin, I think I might see you in July, so I look forward to that and to learning more at the conference.
Thank you.
Thank you. Oh my gosh, Mark. It's like, as the stomach churns as we listen to the situation out in the world, especially for kids.
And yet, the more we learn, the more we realize it's been there.
It's been there.
It's been there. It's been prevalent, and it's been overlooked, or, you know, not believed, or whatever the case may be.
Mm.
So again, I think as heavy as the conversation is, it's the beginning of healing. But you know what I was also thinking about is, I wonder how much, I used an example the other day of media and the power of media to affect the programs that we live by. And I brought up a certain shark movie as when I asked the question, what movie caused people not to want to swim in the ocean? Mm. And everybody answered the same question or same answer. And then I thought, how many other powers of suggestion, you know, land into young adults and, you know, children, and then just into, you know, the audience in general, which normalize this, normalize this, or place the suggestion, or enhance the perversion, or whatever the case may be.
Songs.
Yeah. Songs, film, television, commercials. You know, and I think that's something, you know, we've said this before, but I believe that we'll look back one day saying, considering education and entertainment as separate worlds was one of our biggest mistakes. And I think it leads to some of this systemic breakdown.
Wow, you have said that, Mark, and that's a topic that would be great to explore with you, actually. In the meantime, grateful to have had this conversation. And with that, it's time for our Ask Dorothy segment.
Dear Dorothy, this is Alicia, and I would really like to know why it is so difficult for people to love themselves. I talk to so many people who do not demonstrate self-love, and at the same time, they are some of the most unconditionally loving people when it comes to family and friends. However, they give so much love to people who treat them terribly. I have several people like this in my soul family and want to know how I can help them love themselves.
Dearest Alicia, thank you for this very important question. You're noticing something truly real and very human. I too have observed that self-love is often very challenging, even for the most loving people. At the heart of it, many people learned love as something you give, not something you are. I believe that for so many, love was conditional early on. Many people, including myself, were praised for being useful, good, quiet, strong, or self-sacrificing. And because of this, we and they began to believe that they are loved when they give and that they are safe when they don't need to love themselves. In this frame of mind, loving others becomes fluent. Loving themselves feels unfamiliar and even unsafe. I have learned that this is especially true for empathic, sensitive souls. And I have noticed that if a child learned that harmony kept the peace, they learned to disappear just enough to keep connection. And as an adult, this translates to overgiving, tolerating poor treatment, and confusing endurance with love. They confuse self-love with selfishness. And many deeply loving people equate self-love with being mean, letting people down, and taking up too much space. This often leads them to believe their worth is tied to how much they give, and their identity becomes built around being the loving one. I asked one client today, when discussing his challenges with his mother, "Who are you without the fixing, the forgiving, the holding it all together?" He couldn't answer and suddenly needed to end the conversation. I have discovered that for many, that question creates quiet terror. So they stay in relationships where they are needed, even if they are not cherished. Often those relationships feel familiar, not because they're healthy, but because they echo old emotional feelings. It is important to understand, when you do your best to help them, that you cannot talk someone into self-love if their nervous system believes abandonment equals danger. The best way to help others is to become a mirror and not a teacher. Instead of telling them to love themselves, you can tell them what you see, and you can say something like this: "I notice how much compassion you offer everyone else. I wonder what it would feel like if even a fraction of that kindness turned inward." I've shared with many clients that I have learned to establish clear boundaries and have even done cord-cutting ceremonies to release myself from endless drama. I then choose to connect with my higher self and ask to communicate with their higher self and let them know that I love them and will always love them, and yet I choose to set myself free from further pain. I don't withdraw love. I just withdraw access. And dearest Alicia, I'm now choosing to be surrounded by people who know how to love themselves. I have lovingly accepted that others awakening to self-love is not my responsibility. And I now love myself enough to close the door to endless trauma and drama. Alicia, I'm so grateful for this important question, and I trust that I've helped you make the most elegant choices possible. And remember that I'm here for you always, and feel free to let me know if you need more support.
Thank you, Dorothy. And if you have a question for Dorothy, please write her at askdorothy@lifechangesshow.com.
And for our performance segment, we have musical medicine singer-songwriter, friend of all of us here at the Life Changes Show. Welcome, Colin Martin, to the Life Changes Show. Colin.
Howdy, y'all.
Howdy. I was thinking about you a couple times during that interview segment, and I was thinking, boy, healing music. We need some healing music. And then Mark mentioned how movies, and I mentioned songs, how they could steer us in certain directions, and we need more steering us towards healing. And that's what you're about.
I think so.
It's what you've always been about for as long as I've known you, and every song I've heard of yours, as a matter of fact, even the unwritten ones, in the sense that I've seen you come up with a song spontaneously many, many times, and it lands for the people in the room, and probably for the people not in the room who would need to hear it. So thank you for putting them out. Life to song is also what I was thinking about, and how many of those life stories that Robin spoke about, boy, what songs those could make. Or have you already worked with people in certain situations like that?
You know, I want to say, I don't know if it's fortunate or unfortunate, but I have not. Although, upon contemplating after learning what the topic was today, I think that there would be a lot of value and benefit to doing so. And I would really love to make myself available for that, for the people that need it. Mm.
Yes, as we were talking, you and I, earlier today, about the collection of songs that you have gathered, and we'll talk a little bit about that. So like the fires in LA, so we'll talk about that. But I know we touched on it on the show the last time you were on, just a little bit. I think you were just getting started. Tell us what Life to Song is, and we're going to get to experience some of your music, including Life to Song. But tell us what it is and how it works.
Thank you. Essentially, it's my practice of acting as a translator to bring the stories of others' life experiences and the realizations and everything into the universal language of music and song. And there are a lot of ways that I could talk about this, but that's basically the core of it. Music is a language and it's an energy, and I want to exist to translate all the different ways that we communicate with each other and relate to our lives and relate to ourselves into this common and universal language. And I feel that in doing so, we might have a little bit easier time understanding each other and understanding ourselves. And not to mention the true fact that music is absolutely medicinal, and it's not an entertainment, but it's a way of realigning to our divine nature. And also just to, you know, I don't know, something about reflecting, something I heard Dorothy say about giving love versus being love. Mm. Mm. There's something in there around not treating the music as something that we give and take, but something that we are and allow ourselves to kind of let, I don't know, interact with us or take us over to the point where it doesn't feel like it's something that we have to do. But when it comes to connecting, it's like a natural way of dropping in and sinking into that connectivity with others and ourselves and God and the whole universe.
we'll talk more about music as medicine, actually a piece of it right here, in that you offered yourself and your abilities to a lot of people during the, or soon after the fires, to help write songs of what they were feeling. Because not everybody has tools. Of course, not everybody can write songs, but not everybody has tools to deal with their grief or their pain or their sorrows. And the songs help them do that. I watched that happen. Tell us about that particular experience.
Yeah, it was very cathartic in a lot of ways, and revealing in how profound the gift is of music. Well, let me backtrack. Really, what happened was there was an opportunity to allow people to process what was happening around them in relating to the fires. And I did a lot of those pretty newly after the fires took place, and to just hold space for people to process something that was so fresh and so traumatic was really special all in itself. Mm. And in that space, my intention and my goal is to just listen. And inevitably, I got to witness how every person that I talked to in any context, not just relating to the fires, you know, there's a lot, but I got to witness that everyone essentially has a way of arriving at their own medicine, and the words that people speak and the energy that they present, what they're trying to work out in their minds and through their hearts in a lot of ways is, you know, everybody has everything that they need right inside them. And I get to see people shedding a little bit of that out into the space between us in our conversation. And then as I'm listening, I'm taking some notes and writing down verbatim phrases and words and sentences that they'll say. And then after we're done, I'll put the puzzle together and make a song. And I get to give a person their own medicine right back to them in this beautiful form of song and music. And it's just like, it's like, God, I feel like it's the most profound and powerful and purposeful thing I've ever experienced in my life.
And by everybody has everything they need, you mean as far as their medicine is within them, they just have to access it.
Of course, yes.
Yeah. Is this first song that we're going to hear a result of that kind of experience?
In a way, it's not related to the fires. It's from a different set or collection. I had the opportunity to work closely with a mental health organization called the Inspiring Children Foundation. And I know that Ryan has actually been on the show and y'all have talked with them.
Indeed.
And so I got to connect 10 young people who had kind of, had an experience going through their organization and are now interns or helping out in some way or another. And I think this first one that we're going to listen to is from that collection. And if I'm, and the story is, while maintaining confidentiality and not going too in depth, but it's essentially a young woman is telling her experience growing up and feeling like maybe she wasn't really connected with or cared for in a lot of the ways that she may have wished. And that experience has led her to this knowing that at some point in her life, she wants to provide all the things that she was not able to receive when she was young and growing up. And I remember in the conversation, she said, we talked about a lot of things, but where it really landed is she said, I really want to be a really good mother someday. Mm. And in that moment, that was when she got, some tears came and there was some real emotion behind that declaration. And that's ultimately what the heart of the song is. And I think that it's relatable in some way to the content of the conversation from today's show. Mm. In just kind of being there for children in the ways that they need. And in doing so, we get to be there for ourselves and the child within and continue the healing process. Every generation gets an opportunity to just push the dial a little bit further in the positive direction. So that's what this first song is about.
Mm. Well, what do we call this? Do we say channeled music or medicine music? Write it?
It's best served without a label, but yeah, I wrote this song. Of course I wrote this song.
Okay. Oh, then. All right. Well, just wanted to just make sure I said it the right way. Here's a song written and sung, right? By our performance guest, Colin Martin, here on the Life Changes Show, Only Loved.
One day when I'm ready, I'll hold you in my arms and give you all the love you'll need to navigate the stars. Just like my mama gave me in the only way she could, held on to her heart so tight while she would navigate the flood. And if sometimes my head goes under, I need you to be strong. No matter where the current takes me, I'll always be your home. You can always write me letters and tell me how you feel. Tell me I'm not perfect, but this is always real. More than anything, I wanna be the one you trust. And I promise I'll keep healing, and you're gonna be only loved. And there's no shame in this family that we can't send back to dust. that I wouldn't make if it means I'm watching you grow up. I'm gonna be here for you, my love. And every conversation, like when I call my father and tell him that I'm grateful for everything he gave, even the times that he was not there. I didn't understand it then, and I bottled up resentment while he was just taking care of the children and their mother in the only ways he knew. I won't let the years go by. I'm giving all of them to you. And if I'm working late, I promise that it's only by design. God gives each one a purpose and a gift and the time to heal our wounds. Sometimes it's all we can do. Let the river take us. Let that spirit move. More than anything, I wanna be the one you trust. And I promise I'll keep healing, and you're gonna be only loved. And there's no shame in this family that we can't turn back to dust. And there's no change that I wouldn't make if it means I'm watching you grow up. I'm gonna be here for you, my love. I'm gonna be here for you, my love. I'm gonna be here for you, my love.
Colin Martin. Wow. Thank you for sharing this piece. Yes, what a perfect song for all of these conversations. Colin-Martin.com, Colin-Martin, Martin.com is his website. And there you'll find the Life to Song. You'll find the Colin You Home. And then on Instagram, it's Colin You Home. Speaking of Colin, you home, the events that you had and hopefully are still having, where people came together and they sang from their heart, they sang from their souls, they sang from the bottom of their feet. They were engrossed in music and they became music. That to me was one of the most healing things. When you say music is healing, to do it in community and to do it with abandonment. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Well, you know, I think they say of a lot of things can be more powerful in their expression when done in community. And music is absolutely one of those things. You know, it's one of the only things that we have where we can all be purely expressing ourselves at the same time. And there's no sense of like, people aren't like, it's like a conversation, but everybody gets to talk at the same time. And it's, that's yes. how it's meant. That's how it's meant to be. And, you know, a lot of people exist in the world really afraid to sing. And it's one of the things that's most natural to who and how we are as human beings. And it's a darn shame that people are afraid to sing. And, you know, so some of us feel a strong duty to give them permission by doing it with reckless abandon and bringing all of our friends together and doing it as a group with reckless abandon. Like in that space, nobody is really afraid to do it. Everybody can get there. At least I've witnessed, and it's fun and it's purposeful, and it does something to the energy of the moment, which has an effect on the whole world and for all time moving forward. And the more we do it together, the better off our future is going to be. And I just sense that that's a trend, and that's a way that the world is moving into, where it's happening more and more often, where people come together and sing, just like people could come together and meditate, or people could come together and just connect and have a positive experience to carry forward. It has such a profound impact on the individuals and just, you know, the collective, which is kind of an abstract thing, but, you know, I guess we learn a little bit more about what that means as time rolls on and as we gain more experience in these spaces of being truly in really aligned connection with our fellow brothers and sisters. Mm. And music is just like a beautiful bonding agent for that connection, and that's why we do it.
What was Mark saying earlier? One of the biggest mistakes was to separate education and entertainment. You say that music is not entertainment. It is given to us to help align us to our divine nature.
Yeah. I heard that was a quote from Pythagoras, I think. Which might be some, you know, bull pucky, but I don't know where it came from. But it rings really true, and especially in a world today where, you know, we're bombarded by the, you know, the music entertainment industry, and, you know, people idolize and worship these songs and artists and culture that gets brought up around all that stuff. And, you know, maybe it's inspiring to a degree, but it doesn't do a whole lot for us in the long run, you know, because there isn't a connection. You know, you love an artist or a song, and you can bond with other people when you maybe sing that song that you love with your friends, but the system of it is just, you know, it's backed and founded in some not so savory intentions or contexts. And it's like we were talking earlier, it's like everything good that we have in this world, somebody inevitably finds a way to use it to take advantage of other people, manipulate the things so that they can benefit and just strip all the value and love out of what it was in the first place. And, you know, that's why we exist here today, and that's our journey. We get to, you know, put the pieces back together and bring it all back to the beautiful center that is, I guess God or something at the end of the day, right?
God or something. Before we listen to our last song with you tonight, in what you're saying and bringing it back to so much of what you do at Life to Song, I'm glad you get permission to be able to share these songs with other people, because that song, though that wasn't my experience, that young lady's experience that you shared, my experience was so not that. And yet I found something about that to touch me, not just for her, but for me and for others. And so the experiences, talk about the unification of all this, the experiences in those songs are probably a lot more important, not probably, they are a lot more important because they touch on very human aspects experiences, emotions that need addressing or healing or to be expressed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, if I go through something, I'd be really surprised if there aren't millions of other people that are going through something similar. And the way that we communicate and interact and share our stories, that is what allows us to understand and feel how we're all connected. And we're all, you know, I mean, not to get too hippy dippy, but we're all one, man. your problems are my problems and your healings are my healings. And the more we can understand that and just kind of trust the process that there's some truth to that, you know, it's comforting to know that I'm not alone. So
speaking of I'm not alone, tell us what this next song is about. I know Mark knows it. I purposely didn't listen because I want to listen with the audience on this one, because I thought, okay, this is going to hit something. I know I'm alive.
Yes. Oh, I got to have a really beautiful conversation with a DBT therapy. I don't know if you're familiar. I'm not very familiar with that style. It's a specific type of therapy. But this guy, and you know, I think he works at Harvard actually, and he's really well respected in his field. And so I got to talk to him about what's important about your work to you. Why do you do it? You know, and he said that, you know, at one point in his life, when he was a young man, he had a friend who was very, who was suicidal, and he just wanted to really understand what it was that was that makes people that way, makes people feel like they want to end their life. And something in the spectrum of feeling alone and feeling a lack of connection leads people down that path. And so he dedicated his life to specifically working with people with suicidal tendencies. And this song is kind of to sum up the energy of what he was speaking to. And to be able to sing, I know and I feel that I am alive and I'm not alone is really powerful. And this song wanted to express some of those words and statements with melody and rhythm and harmony, and thus send them into the fabric of the universe with a little extra oomph for the healing. Yeah. So,
Well, thank you. Well, this is Colin Martin's song. He's singing on this as well. I Know I'm Alive, pre-recorded, shared here on the Life Changes Show.
Scars.
I know I'm alive. I got to just experience this great show and ending with this song. Thank you, Colin Martin. Again, colin-martin.com is Colin Martin. There you'll find the Life to Song and the other things we were talking about. Colin, you home. Like you'll find on Instagram at Colin, C-O-L-I-N, you home. And speaking of Life to Song, we have posted a video of Colin Martin doing a Life to Song with Jeff Skult, who was also on the show. That is called So Golden. Go and enjoy that at our website, lifechangeshow.com, and look up Colin Martin, and for that matter, look up Robin Boyle Leisure. But before we get to the thank yous, Colin, it's always a pleasure.
Yes, it really is, Filippo and Mark and Dorothy and everybody. Thank you guys so much for having me on again. I really, really feel so grateful to be in relation and in connection with this show and your community. So all gratitude here.
You're the greatest, Colin.
Love you, Mark.
Looking forward to more. Colin, all the best to you. And thank you. With a big thank you to Colin Martin and another big thank you to our interview guest, Robin Boyle Leisure. That is our show. On behalf of our executive producer, Dorothy Lee Donahue, and our executive producer and co-host, Mark Leisure, and our whole family here at the Life Changes Show, I am your host, Filippo Voltaggio, reminding you that as your life changes, like ours surely did tonight, we're here for you. Ciao, everyone.
You have been listening to the Life Changes Show on the BBS Radio Network. Listen live every Monday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Time and visit us online at lifechangesnetwork.com, on Facebook at the Life Changes Show, and on Twitter at Life Changes Show. Join us again next week as we consciously explore and embrace the only constant, life changes. The Life Changes Network is an entertainment network. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and participants and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of Life Changes.